At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. This episode is rated a 5. In May of 1996, two women in their 20s took a vacation to the Shenandoah National Park, located in the state of Virginia, to embrace its beauty and enjoy the tranquility of its nature. Unfortunately, what was supposed to be a celebratory trip ended in tragedy. When the pair didn't return home by the date originally planned, family reported them missing. After an intensive search, park authorities found the two women dead. They had been bound and gagged, and their throats had been slashed. For nearly 3 decades, though, the case remained cold and unsolved, and their killer remained at large. That is, until June of this year, 2024. This episode is titled Solved: Murders in the Shenandoah. So without further ado, let's get started. Who more commonly went by Julie, and Laura Winans, who went by Lolly, met in 1994 at Woods Women, a now-defunct nonprofit organization in Minnesota that focused on education and adventure travel for women. Now, although it was much more taboo and much less accepted in the 90s, Julie and Lolly were romantically involved. And even though the two women were from very different backgrounds, they bonded over their mutual love for the outdoors. According to a 2018 feature article by Kim Dinan for Blue Ridge Outdoors magazine, Lolly was described as a, quote, microbrew drinking, fish following, cigarette smoking, good time girl, end quote. But don't let that description fool you. Lolly was from a well-to-do family in Michigan, but being the free-spirited, adventure-seeking person she was, she rejected the privilege of her birth. Instead, Lolly left home after high school and enrolled in college in Vermont, although she later dropped out. A few years later, in 1994, Lolly enrolled in Unity College near Waterville, Maine, where she began studying to become a wilderness guide, which she did go on to accomplish. Julie, on the other hand, was a geologist in the making. In Dinan's article, Julie was described as a high achiever and sports enthusiast. In high school, she won the Minnesota State Doubles Tennis Championship, and in college, she traveled to Europe to study the extinction of dinosaurs. Julie graduated from college with honors, summa cum laude. She spoke fluent Spanish, and she often worked with special populations, including migrant workers and people suffering abuse. After college, Julie moved to Richmond, Vermont, and began working at a bookstore in Burlington, Vermont. Most recently, however, Julie had just accepted a new job in Lake Champion, Vermont, which she was slated to start on June 1st, 1996. And this was actually the reason Julie and Lolly decided to take a trip to the Shenandoah National Park. It was a celebration of her landing that new job. So on Sunday, May 19th, 1996, 24-year-old Julie and 26-year-old Lolly, along with their beloved golden retriever, Taj, arrived to the Shenandoah National Park to embark on an adventurous backpacking trip. They were both excited to visit the historic park and immerse themselves in the transformative powers of nature and the outdoors. According to Dynan's reporting, on this day, the two women and Taj launched off into the woods on the White Oak Canyon Trail. A few days later, though, they emerged back out of the park due to rain. They then hitched a ride with a park ranger to renew their camping permit before setting back out into the park again. They then climbed the Hawksbill Mountain, the highest point in the park, and then they set up camp that night off of one of the horse trails. It was an idyllic spot next to a mountain stream near the famous Appalachian Trail. The thing is, though, after this, Julie and Lolly were never seen again. At least, not alive, that is. You see, Julie and Lolly were scheduled to return home toward the end of the month. But when that date came and went, and their families hadn't heard from them, Julie's father became incredibly worried. So on May 31st, 1996, her father, Tom Williams, reported Julie and Lolly missing. Thankfully, park rangers took the missing persons report incredibly serious and began an intensive search for the two women that same day. The first thing park rangers located was their car, which was parked just north of the Skyland Lodge, which is a popular gathering place with a bar and a restaurant and cabins for tourists to stay in. Then they found Taj, Julie's and Lolly's golden retriever. Deputy Chief Ranger at the Shenandoah National Park, Bridget Bonnet, said, quote, "We started doing hasty searches to cover all of those trail corridors in that general area to see if we could locate them. At some point during the hasty searches, we did locate the dog," end quote. According to Dynan's reporting, they found Taj wandering through the park unleashed, which was honestly even more of an indication that something wasn't right. Then, the next day, on June 1st, 1996, the day Julie was supposed to start her new job, park rangers found the two women's bodies near their campsite. They were found nude, and they had been bound and gagged and assaulted, and their throats had been cut as well. The wooded campsite was only about a quarter mile down the trail from Skyline Drive and about a half mile from the Skyland Lodge. And investigators who discovered their bodies speculated that they had probably been killed on May 24th, the last day they were ever seen, which means their bodies had been lying there for over a week. So the question was, how could two bodies lie undiscovered in such a high-traffic, popular part of the park, especially on a busy holiday weekend, because the weekend they were killed was during Memorial Day? Bonnet, however, provided an explanation to this question. She explained that one of the backcountry regulations at the time was that backpackers had to camp away from designated trails and fire roads and developed areas. Bonnet said, quote, "It wasn't a heavily used or heavily traveled trail. They were following the backcountry regulations at the time, which required them to be out of sight," end quote. Now, it's probably no surprise to you that solving murders or crimes in national parks can be a difficult feat. When crime happens in a national park, the investigation is often much more complex than if the crime had occurred off of public land due to several factors. For starters, investigators have to sort out the jurisdiction. Christopher Smith, special agent in charge of operations for the National Park Service Investigative Services Branch, I know that's a mouthful, so we'll just call it ISB, but Christopher explained, quote, "The first step in conducting an investigation in a national park is identifying what the jurisdiction of the land is where the incident occurred," end quote. According to Dynan's article, the Shenandoah National Park falls exclusively under federal jurisdiction, which means only the federal government has law enforcement authority. Ranger Bonnet said, quote, "Our law enforcement staff was involved in the initial crime scene security. We had special agents that are part of the National Park Service handling the investigation in conjunction with the FBI. We also worked with the Virginia State Police's crime scene unit to have them come and process the crime scene along with the FBI because at the time, we did not have the equipment," end quote. Also, finding a suspect of a crime in a national park is quite challenging too, because so many people are consistently entering and exiting the park. The year that Julie and Lolly were murdered, in 1996, over 1.5 million people visited the Shenandoah, which could easily allow a perpetrator to slip through the park gates unnoticed. Then the crime scene in a national park is also tricky. Bonnet said, quote, "Any type of crime that occurs in an outdoor environment, your crime scene is probably 10 times larger than it would be in a residence. You have the initial crime scene where something happened, and then you have the outer crime scene because you don't know which way the person came in or went. So the crime scene in and of itself tends to be larger and harder to contain and process," end quote. Regardless, upon discovering Julie's and Lolly's bodies, the National Park Service and the FBI conducted a joint nationwide search for their killer, or even possibly their killers. This included following up on at least 15,000 leads. But ultimately, investigators got nowhere. All the leads just led to dead ends. But about a year later, in July of 1997, a suspect finally emerged. One day that summer, a Canadian tourist by the name of Yvonne Malbasha was riding her bike on Skyline Drive in the Shenandoah, which is a popular bike riding trail in the park. As she pedaled her way through the park, steadily taking in the views, a man driving by in a truck forced her off the road. He then pulled his vehicle over and stepped out as he yelled profanities at her, enraged. He approached her and tried to force her into his truck, but she fought him off and made a run for it, taking cover behind a tree. The man then re-entered his truck and tried numerous times to run her over, unsuccessfully. He eventually gave up and sped away, and thankfully, Yvonne was able to get away and find help. Later that same day, park rangers found the guy, who was later identified as Daryl David Rice, and they apprehended him as he was trying to leave the park. And y'all, they were even more relieved for Yvonne's safety when they searched his truck and found hand and leg restraints inside. Creepy. Anyway, Rice was a guy in his mid-20s who was living in Columbia, Maryland. He was a single guy with no kids, and he had no previous criminal record. But don't let that fool you. As investigators looked into Rice more, they discovered that the dude was a bit unhinged. Apparently, Rice had allegedly been fired from a job at MCI System House in June of 1997, so just about a month prior, because apparently he was exhibiting extremely hostile behavior at work. His former coworkers told investigators that he yelled sexual and explicit profanities at them, that he punched a hole in the wall of the men's bathroom. He would steal their lunches and purposefully bump into them so that they would spill their coffee. One time, he even took down a woman's picture and threw it in the trash. Like, dude sounds like a nightmare. So, anyway, according to the article by Kim Dinan, Rice pleaded guilty to the abduction of Yvonne, and he was sentenced to 135 months in a Virginia federal prison. But back to Julie and Lolly. After interviewing Rice following his arrest, investigators believe that he was potentially responsible for their murders. According to prosecution documents, quote, "Rice became a possible suspect for a variety of reasons, including the obvious parallels in geographic location, the predatory behavior exhibited, and the exclusive selection of female victims," end quote. Then he also was shown on park security footage to be in the Shenandoah on May 25th and 26th, as well as again on June 1st. So he was, in fact, in the park right around the time that Julie and Lolly were murdered.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It wasn't until a few years later, though, in April of 2001, that prosecutors felt like they had gathered enough circumstantial evidence to move forward with a case against Rice. On April 10, 2001, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the indictment of Rice for the murders of Julie Williams and Lolly Winans, nearly 5 years after their deaths. In a news conference announcing his indictment, prosecutors brought forth even more circumstantial evidence. They alleged, quote, "Rice has stated on several occasions that he enjoys assaulting women because they are, in his words, more vulnerable than men," end quote. Additionally, prosecutors alleged, Rice also stated that they deserved to die because of their sexual orientation. Ultimately, Rice was charged with 4 counts of capital murder, 2 of which were considered a hate crime because of his alleged statements about their sexual identities. And because of this, his indictment invoked a federal sentencing enhancement. So if he were to be convicted, he could have received the death penalty. But we don't need to discuss that because he was never sentenced. You see, even though prosecutors spent years building a case against Rice, they still lacked forensic evidence. And in 2003, a hair found at the scene was tested for DNA. The results indicated that it did not match Rice, nor did it match Julie or Lolly. So they had the wrong guy, and DNA excluded him. After that, the prosecution's case crumbled. In 2004, the charges against Rice were dismissed, but they were dismissed without prejudice, meaning he could still be charged at a later date if, you know, they found more to potentially link him to the murders. Now, I don't know if they just firmly believed Rice was the guy or if they just didn't have any other suspects to go after, but it seems like they kind of just gave up after this. Julie's and Lolly's case went cold, and there wouldn't be any movement or progress in solving it for years. Meanwhile, in 2011, Daryl David Rice was released from prison. According to Dinan's article, he was last reported to be in Durango, Colorado in 2014. Apparently, police there began receiving multiple calls from frightened residents saying they'd seen him in the area. But the Durango police chief at the time, Jim Spratlin, dismissed the sightings and said people were overreacting. He said, quote, "All I know is he's not wanted and we ain't looking for him," end quote. It wasn't until 2016, around the 20th anniversary of their murders, that the FBI started generating renewed public interest in the case, and they circulated a press release and updated posters of Julie and Lolly. At the time, Dee Ribisky with the FBI said, quote, "The case remains an open and active investigation. It's our hope that any continued coverage of the girls' murders will one day generate that one crucial piece of information that may bring someone to justice and peace for their families," end quote. But it didn't appear that those efforts really generated anything new, because it wasn't until 5 years after that, in 2021, that any new information about the case was released. According to the reporting of Bruce LeShan of WUSA 9 in Washington, D.C., the FBI released another press release, still pleading for answers. In part, that press release stated, quote, "Over the past 25 years, we are cognizant that those who were hiking in the park at the time of the murders, were visiting local establishments, and even resided in the area may not be local to Virginia any longer. Therefore, it is crucial that this case continues to be shared throughout the country. It is possible there are people anywhere from Virginia to the West Coast that could have information valuable to investigators," end quote. However, also according to LeShan's 2021 story, a lawyer for Rice, Deidre Enright, said she believed that DNA, which she said was sitting in an evidence locker at the FBI lab in Quantico, would lead to the killer. It just simply needed to be reanalyzed and retested. Why, you ask? Because apparently, according to Enright, who is the founder and director of the Innocence Project at the University of Virginia School of Law, but anyway, according to her, the last time the DNA was analyzed was nearly 20 years prior, when they excluded Rice from the DNA. Essentially, the results failed to pinpoint any killer. But if you're thinking what I'm thinking, forensic technology has dramatically advanced since then. And that's the point that Enright was trying to make. According to her, the FBI had mailed DNA on a gag used at the crime scene, as well as hairs, as in multiple, not just one. Now, based on my research, it appears that the FBI and investigators who had been working on the case were still thinking that Rice was likely the culprit. But Enright, on the other hand, maintained that Rice was too disorganized to plot the murders of Julie and Lolly. She said, quote, "Daryl Rice is pretty much a hot mess. He wasn't able to get a woman off a bike, and she threw a soda at him," end quote. Then Enright went on to say, quote, "There's male DNA on the gag in Julie's mouth. There are hairs under the duct tape. They weren't Daryl Rice's," end quote. Back in 2021, Enright also said that the FBI might not need any new tips to solve the case. Instead, she pointed to an alternative suspect, a man by the name of Richard Ivanitz. According to LaShawn's reporting, police allege that Ivonitz killed three teenagers in 1996, 12-year-old Katie Lisk, 15-year-old Kristen Lisk, and 16-year-old Sophia Silva. And while that story has little to do with this one, it's pretty horrible. Police said he abducted the Lisk sisters off their porch after school. He then proceeded to murder them and dump their bodies in the South Anna River. So yeah, I told you it was an awful story. Anyway, according to LaShawn's reporting, prosecutors even admitted that DNA at Julie's and Lolly's crime scene did not exclude Ivonitz as a suspect. Unfortunately, the only justice that was served to Ivonitz was his cowardly actions. As police were closing in on him in Florida, after he had abducted another teen in South Carolina, who luckily escaped and alerted police to his location, Ivonitz died by suicide. And according to Enright, Rice's defense team pointed to Ivonitz as the potential killer over 20 years ago. Enright said, quote, "Richard Mark Ivonitz killed people. He told his sister right before he killed himself, 'I killed more people than I can remember. That's not three,'" end quote. Then Enright challenged the FBI to re-examine the DNA. She offered, quote unquote, "You test the evidence and then you say I'm wrong." Well, turns out Enright was both right and wrong. She was right about the fact that the evidence should be retested with advanced technology, and she was right that Rice was not the person who did it. But she was wrong about Ivonitz. According to a press release issued by the FBI field office in Richmond, Virginia, on June 20th, 2024, a suspect has been identified in the murders of Julie Williams and Lolly Winans. The FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Virginia announced that a man by the name of Walter Leo Jackson Sr., a convicted serial rapist, was responsible for brutally killing Julie and Lolly in 1996. U.S. Attorney Christopher R. Kavanaugh said, quote, "After 28 years, we are now able to say who committed the brutal murders of Lolly Winans and Julie Williams in Shenandoah National Park. I want to again extend my condolences to the Winans and Williams families and hope today's announcement provides some small measure of solace," end quote. The press release stated that in 2021, a new FBI Richmond investigative team was assigned to conduct a methodic review of the case. In the review, special agents, intelligence analysts, and other FBI Richmond employees reassessed hundreds of leads and interviews. They spent countless hours identifying and prioritizing evidence from the crime scene to retest, and then they submitted those items for analysis to an accredited private lab. Recently, the private lab successfully extracted DNA from several of the items, and a DNA profile was submitted to CODIS, or the FBI's Combined DNA Index System. Lo and behold, they got a positive match to Walter Leo Jackson, a man originally from the Cleveland, Ohio area. Stanley M. Metter, an FBI Richmond special agent in charge, said, quote, "Even though we had this DNA match, we took additional steps and compared evidence from Lolly and Julie's murders directly to a buccal swab containing Jackson's DNA. Those results confirmed we had the right man and finally could tell the victims' families we know who is responsible for this heinous crime," end quote. According to the FBI press release, Jackson died in an Ohio prison in March of 2018. He had a lengthy criminal history, including kidnapping, rapes, and assaults. Apparently, he was an avid hiker and known to visit the Shenandoah National Park. At the time of their murders in 1996, investigators believe he was driving a chestnut brown 1984 AMC Eagle 30. He later drove a 1979 Ford Econoline 250 van. The FBI said he was known to use temporary tags, alter his license plates, and frequently change vehicles. They also believe he could be responsible for other unsolved crimes, and they are working to make connections. So they are now urging anyone with information on Jackson, who went by Leo, to call 1-800-CALL-FBI or to submit an online tip at tips.fbi.gov. Today, Julie and Lolly would be 52 and 54 years old. Tom Williams, Julie's father, told Bruce LaShawn for WUSA 9 back in 2021 that he still thinks about his daughter every single day, and he often reflects on the last time he saw her alive. It was Easter weekend in 1996, and the family had spent the holiday together in Florida. Tom said, quote, "That was April. Within 60 days, she was dead," end quote. Not only are Julie and Lolly still remembered by their loved ones, but also by the members of the FBI and rangers at the Shenandoah National Park. Park Ranger Bonet said it literally shifted the perspective she had of her own career. She said, quote, "I was a very young ranger at the time, and it affected my career. Before that, I may not have taken the law enforcement part of my job as seriously as I do now. I was a backcountry seasonal, you know? I was having a blast. I didn't think about people getting murdered in the park. I changed the way I thought about things after that. I changed the way I trained for things. I changed a lot of stuff about how I did my job. It had a profound effect on me, and I know it did on the people who worked on that case," end quote. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of Chronicle 82. As always, be sure to check out my social media, where I always post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Okay, well, that's all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner. Campus crony Alexis McDonald is my research assistant, and Giari Gassaway is my editor and producer. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.